Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. Louisa Thomas discusses Louisa, her biography of John Quincy Adams' wife, in conversation with Baltimore Raven John Urschel. Tuesday, April 26th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello again, one and all. Dan Rodericks here, Baltimore Sun columnist. This is Roughly Speaking, the podcast of the Baltimore Sun. It's finally Election Day in Maryland, Tuesday, April 26th. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about who won and who lost. Republican analyst Richard Cross, Goucher Poll director Malia Cromer, and the Sun's media critic David Zurawick will be joining me for that show. So please be listening for Roughly Speaking, the day after episode. It usually drops in the early afternoon. That'll be tomorrow, Wednesday. Today on the show, Cokie Roberts of NPR and ABC News, the longtime political commentator. She was in Baltimore last week to talk about her new book, Capital Dames, about the women of Washington just before, during, and after the Civil War. We'll bring you that conversation with Cokie Roberts in just a few minutes. We'll also hear from Charles Bethay, the new curator of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture, about the museum's look into issues raised by the death of Freddie Gray 1 year ago. We start the show with one of two book reviews today by critic Paula Gallagher. The first one is called Alligator Candy. This is a powerful memoir by David Kushner, a Rolling Stone contributor, about his brother, John, who was kidnapped and murdered in Florida in 1973.
David Kushner's early childhood was near idyllic. Born in 1968 to observant Jewish parents with liberal ideals, Kushner and his two older brothers, John and Andy, had license to roam free in their Tampa suburb. Days were filled with bike rides, games, and exploration of the natural world that surrounded both their home and school. But one October afternoon, John took a solo ride to the 7-Eleven to buy snappy gator gum for David and himself. He never returned. Alligator Candy, a memoir, is the story of the tragedy that affected not only the Kushner family, but the entire community. David, a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, a journalism professor at Princeton, and an author of several nonfiction titles, tells this deeply personal story with candor and generosity. What does he remember about the last time he saw his brother alive, and can he trust that memory? Would John be alive today if almost five-year-old David hadn't asked for that gum? The rest of his life from that point forward was marked by having a brother who had been abducted and murdered. Childhood was no longer safe. His boogeyman was real. Actually, he had two boogeymen. The men who had confessed to treating his brother in a way that was far worse than anything he'd heard from his old edition of Grimm's fairy tales. How does a family move on? Kushner credits his parents for allowing him and his older brother the freedom to move beyond the fear, to continue to have as normal a childhood as possible. He acknowledges his Jewish faith, and more importantly, the community that came forward to support his family from the moment John went missing. As he got older, he knew that his memories of his brother's murder were incomplete, and much of what he thought he knew was based on a combination of overheard conversations, conjecture, and rumors. And although he craved answers to what was a mystery to him, he didn't want to subject his parents to painful recollections. At 13, he went to the library to request microfilm of the Tampa Tribune from October 1973. What he read satisfied his need for more information, but also led to further questions. One fact remained. He was becoming a man, a bar mitzvah, while John would forever remain a boy. Kushner talks about other famous cases involving missing and brutalized children, explaining how laws have come into being as a result. An existing legal loophole allowed for a parole hearing for one of John's killers, compelling David and Andy to testify. The thought of this man getting out into the world was stupefying. This is a memoir that marks a lifetime of remembering, searching, and gathering. Kushner's evocative prose took me back to my own early 70s childhood with just the right period details and nostalgia. Despite its difficult topic, Alligator Candy is compulsively readable and highly recommended. For Roughly Speaking, I'm Paula Gallagher.
Paula Gallagher is a Baltimore County librarian who recommends books for Roughly Speaking. She'll be back in a few minutes with another review. This one, a collection of essays called The Books That Changed My Life. Speaking of books, Cokie Roberts has just turned out, by my count, her fifth book. In this one, the longtime political analyst for NPR and ABC News writes about women of Washington before, during, and after the Civil War. Cokie Roberts was in Baltimore last week to speak at the Enoch Pratt Free Library, but she stopped by the Sun to share a few tales from Capital Dames, with some fascinating connections to Baltimore and Maryland, including the woman at the center of a deadly scandal involving the son of Francis Scott Key. So, Cokie Roberts, welcome to Roughly Speaking, my podcast. It's nice to meet you and have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I want to start with Teresa Sickles, only because that's such a salacious story, and I know a little bit about it, and there's a Maryland connection to it.
Right, there is a Maryland connection, absolutely.
Yeah, we're very proud here of Francis Scott Key.
Right, well.
But many Baltimoreans don't know much about his son.
Well, even Philip Barton Key, though, was a very well-respected man. He was a lawyer. He was loved in the community here and in Washington. And his wife died and left him, you know, as a young, good-looking man. And he started courting, it's a nice word, the wife of Congressman Sickles. And she was this beautiful young, very young girl. And Sickles was a jerk. He had gone to, he had married her quite young. He then went to England to work for James Buchanan, who was at that point the ambassador to the Court of St. James. And he took with him to England a prostitute. And it was in all the newspapers. And, you know, poor Teresa is home with the baby. And finally, he calls for her and dispatches the prostitute home. And she comes to England, where she's very popular. She's very pretty. And then he gets elected to Congress. And they come to Washington, living on Lafayette Square, right at the White House. And he's always having affairs, including with a woman in Baltimore, in fact. And so she took up with Philip Barton Key. And Sickles would have never known anything about it because he was preoccupied. But somebody who was out to get Key wrote him an anonymous letter.
That's how he found out that his wife was having an affair.
And so then he summoned the servants, and they said it was true. They were scandalized by it. So he, Sickles, on a Sunday morning when most people were in church, goes to the place where Key is staying, and which is, again, right at the White House. Key comes out, and Sickles shoots him in cold blood. And it was, of course, a huge scandal. And the women of the city were all on Key's side. They couldn't stand Sickles. They loved Key. He was very good looking. And they were horrified. And so then Sickles, who was a close friend, by this time Buchanan is president, he is in jail, but being wined and dined in jail. He has Edwin Stanton, who became Secretary of War under Lincoln, as his chief attorney. He had a ton of attorneys, but he had Stanton as his chief one. And Stanton came up with, for the first time, the defense of not guilty because of temporary insanity. Now, how you can be temporarily insane when you have premeditated, arming yourself, going, waiting for the guy to, you know, emerge from his house and all of that.
You've checked with the servants.
Yeah, all of that, and you shoot him. I don't know, but he won. And again,
He
got off, and the women of the city, again, who didn't like him, were all convinced it was a political deal, that it was because, it was because he was a friend of Buchanan. But the jurors were interviewed, and they said, no, it's just that she was unfaithful. And so if a wife is unfaithful, then, you know, her lover deserves to get shot. That's it. End of story. And so, Dan, this is the great thing. The way I know that is that I could read all the newspapers at the time, because now newspapers are all online, and I can sit and read a newspaper from 1855.
You know, I was going to ask you about your research on this, and the newspapers were thriving at the time.
Oh, were
this
they ever?
Before the Civil War and during the Civil War.
Yeah. And immediately after. There were hundreds of newspapers, and many, many of them had correspondents in Washington, including, by the way, female correspondents. And so I could just sit and read them. And you would love this, because what happens is it's the whole newspaper. So all the ads are there, all the, you know.
These are newspapers that are gone forever.
Long gone.
But are online.
Online. And it's so fabulous. But you can waste days just reading them, you know.
Yeah, I love to read
so
the advertisements, too, which often appeared on the front page of newspapers,
Absolutely.
Too.
Sure.
Well, I'm not going to apologize for starting with that story.
No,
because
it's a great story.
I think it's a great story. And, and we know the story of Francis Scott Key so well here in Baltimore.
Right.
I don't know if many people know about what happened to his son, who, by the way, I think was U.S. attorney at one point in Washington.
He was,
right?
And the house that he lived in when he was married is a beautiful old home that is now Murray School. My grandchildren go to that school. And so he was quite a personage. And and his sister, let me see if I can get this straight. I'm a Southerner, so I should be able to get this. His sister was married to the Chief Justice? I think that's right.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, Roger B. Taney.
Yeah.
Roger B. Taney was related to Francis Scott Key somehow.
His daughter was married to Roger B. Taney. Right. So,
well, this is a fascinating idea for
and
a book,
the way,
and
Teresa,
well executed.
What? Teresa Sickles, we never heard from again.
After the murder, she was packed off
to New York and never heard from again.
Now Sickles became somewhat infamous during the Civil War, right? Because
Pickett's charge, terrible maneuver at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
And the question is, was he heroic or was he not? And he remained a controversial person and lost a leg.
Something I learned from this book, a woman could be first lady and not married to the president.
That's true.
Harriet Lane.
Harriet Lane was James Buchanan's niece. He was a bachelor. In fact, he was accused in the public press of being a homosexual. But when he went to England as an ambassador, she went with him as his hostess, and she was wildly popular. Queen Victoria named her an honorary ambassadress, and she was wined and dined in the courts of Great Britain. And in fact, one of her friends wrote to her and said, "You better marry over there because you're never going to get such a good shot here." And you know, the pickings here aren't so great, and you're gotten pretty uppity, so you'd be better off over there. But
she did not.
She then did serve as first lady through her uncle's tempestuous term as the last president before the Civil War.
Was he a drunk?
I don't think he was a drunk. He was just hapless. Because the women who wrote about him were very frank about him. Abigail Brooks Adams, who was Charles Francis Adams' wife, called him a silly old toad. But she didn't say he was drunk, and she would have. So, but Andrew Johnson was a drunk, but I don't think Buchanan was. But at any rate, Harriet Lane, it's another Baltimore story, because she ended up years later marrying a man who was here, and then she started the Children's Hospital here, which is still now the big pavilion at the Johns Hopkins Children's Hospital.
How do you like that?
And she was a very interesting person.
I noted that there were 13 women who served as first ladies who were not married to presidents.
Mostly,
I guess, nieces or sisters who served as first ladies of widowed presidents. I never... 13 has surprised me by that number.
That surprises me, too. Well, Andrew Johnson's wife was there, but she was not well. And her daughters, she had two daughters, married daughters, who lived with them, and they would usually do the honors.
You must have been thinking the Civil War was such a crucible. There must have been a lot of interesting stories in Washington going into the war and during the war. So that's why you chose this, right?
Well, I chose the Civil War period because my publisher made me.
Okay. It was a good choice.
I really hate the Civil War. You know, it was 600,000 dead Americans because the politicians couldn't get their act together.
Oh, there's a lot of reasons to hate it.
You know, and of course all my ancestors fought on the losing side. And so it's an awful war, but it's a war that is important, very important in our history, and actually to do the research about the time leading up to the war is a very useful thing for a political reporter, particularly right now.
Right.
And so I did find it fascinating, but I also always find when I'm doing these history books the women so, so interesting because their letters are just much more fun, you know? They're franker and funnier, and they don't expect anybody to be reading them 150 years later. They just think that somebody would just read it and toss it, whereas the men, you know, correct them and edit them and all of that.
Thinking that they're writing for posterity, right?
Exactly.
With the women, you say they were more frank and
much
funny
more frank.
In their letters
right.
and blunt and not worried about who might read it someday.
Right. For instance, Verena Davis, Jefferson Davis's wife, who was one of my favorites, he's not, but she is, was furious when her friend Adele Cutts, who was Dolly Madison's great niece, Adele Cutts was about to marry Stephen Douglas, the senator from Illinois who had defeated Lincoln. And she couldn't stand Douglas. Most of the women couldn't stand Douglas. And she wrote to her mother in just cold fury and said, the dirty trickster with his first wife's money is, he's a drunk, she said, marrying a brilliant girl because she is poor and her father is proud. But then she says, it's a good thing there's a new water system coming to Washington so that sparing his wife's olfactories, he may wash a little oftener.
Wow.
And then she
says, good stuff.
It's good stuff. She says, if he don't, people will, you know, build bigger rooms with more perfect ventilation. So, you know, from the men's, it's great stuff.
What happens to letters? Like, she wrote that letter, I don't know to whom.
She wrote it to her mother.
Okay, so what happens to the mother keeps the letter forever? The mother dies. It ends
right.
up in her
right.
affairs,
right.
and it's passed along, and
right.
then someday ends up in the Library of Congress.
Ends up in ends up in her husband's papers.
Okay.
So that's what normally happens. So it would be in among the letters of Jefferson Davis.
I have this image from your book, Verena Davis, second wife of Jefferson Davis.
Yeah, but his first wife, he was married to for about 15 minutes. I mean, she
yes,
was, yeah.
but. On the honeymoon of Verena Davis
yes.
and Jefferson Davis,
I mean,
didn't they visit the
oh,
first
it was
wife's
so horrible,
grave?
Awful, awful.
So,
his first
I'm
wife.
I'm picturing
oh,
this
oh,
in a movie.
Now,
you
Jefferson
know,
like, Davis is not a nice man.
No,
his first wife was the daughter of Zachary Taylor, who became president, of course, and they were married very briefly. She immediately got yellow fever and died, and he. He and Verena married in Mississippi and then went to Louisiana to his first wife's grave. But then they went on to New Orleans and had a good time.
Okay, yeah, but still, it had to stop
I know,
at the first wife's grave.
It's not good.
Now, Mary Todd Lincoln.
Tough case.
Tough woman, right? We get a lot of depictions of her as being...
Crazy.
Oh, crazy, depressive, angry, pushy, possessive, paranoid.
All true.
Yeah. And I was interested in Elizabeth Keckley, though,
yeah.
because we don't hear too much about her.
Well, so Mary Lincoln, I think in modern times, would be considered a bipolar. You know, she could not control her emotions, and they were quite dramatic. Although she and Abraham Lincoln clearly loved each other, and she, when she was, you know, sort of right, she gave him good advice. But the women of Washington didn't really want anything to do with her. And some of it was completely unfair. Some of it was that they were basically Confederate sympathizers and they didn't like this guy. Part of it was that they thought she was some coarse Western woman, which was not true, but they labeled her that. And then her own personality made it hard. So her best friends really became the people who worked for her. And one was a nurse named Rebecca Pomeroy, but another was Elizabeth Keckley, who is always described as Mrs. Lincoln's dressmaker, but she was a lot more than that. She was in Baltimore too, by the way. See, the Baltimore connections all over the place here. She had been a slave in North Carolina, had moved with the family to Missouri, bought her freedom, and then come here to Baltimore, hoping to teach young African American women to sew. And she couldn't make a living that way. So she moved on to Washington. She was a very talented, really, designer. And she started making the fancy clothes of the most prominent people. And she established a business. She wasn't just a seamstress. She was a couturier, and she had a shop with people working for her and all of that.
An ex-slave.
And because she had sewn for the best, including Verena Davis, who tried to convince her to come south with them when they seceded, but Mrs. Keckley had sense enough not to do that.
I'm going to stay here.
So she started working with Mary Lincoln, and they became very good friends. And after Lincoln was assassinated, Mary Lincoln basically went nuts and stayed in the White House for weeks. And was completely out of her mind. And Elizabeth Keckley cared for her and then took her back to Chicago and then finally convinced Mrs. Lincoln she had to go home. She had to attend to her business. But then she wrote a tell-all book about the Lincoln White House, and it was a huge scandal. And she lost her business because other people were afraid she might write tell-all books about them. Hmm. And African Americans thought she was disloyal to Lincoln. But she already was engaged in social service. She had understood when enslaved people started showing up in Washington before emancipation that they were in terrible straits. They had no jobs, no housing, no anything. So she formed the Contraband, as they were called, Contraband Relief Association. And because of her contacts, she was able to raise money and awareness. And then after emancipation, it became the Freedmen's Relief Association. And that was her doing, and she was very involved in that.
Was there a woman, perhaps one that we've already talked about, that particularly fascinated you, that you discovered a lot about?
You know, I liked them. I always like learning about these women because they're always different from each other and have different strengths and weaknesses. Of the political women, who are the ones I always enjoy the most just because I'm me, you know, but Verena Davis was a total delight. A woman named Virginia Clay, she was married to Clement Clay, a senator from Alabama, and she was this frivolous, funny, flirtatious young woman. They were very young, you know, they married very young. And she wrote a book about herself later in life called A Belle of the 50s, about herself. But then the war, and this is what was so interesting about the book, was that the war changed them all. And so when she had been, before the war, this, you know, socializing, funny, bright, politically interested, but certainly not serious person, the war turned her into a refugee as a Southerner, and then she ended up being very purposeful. And she was an important voice for suffrage, and she stood on public platforms making speeches herself, not trying to influence a man. And she stood on platforms with people like Horace Greeley, someone she wouldn't have spoken to before the war.
Was that a criteria for you, that they had to have had a purposeful life?
No. My real criteria were that they had letters. Because that's what you need, you know, to write about them. But I did want to have sort of three from the South and three from the North to focus on. And she was fun to find. And, of course, Maryland's own Elizabeth Blair Lee, who stayed true to the Union, was also just a fascinating person. And we have thousands of her letters because her husband was in the Union Navy and was away all the time.
And then later on, U.S. Senator Blair Lee, and then
a number
of Blair Lees.
Her son was, yeah.
Yeah. The first Blair Lee I knew was Lieutenant Governor of Maryland.
Right,
and then, of course, his son Blair Lee the 4th?
Something like that.
Yeah.
But her son Blair Lee, in fact, was the first United States senator popularly elected after the constitutional amendment calling for the popular election of senators.
It's another thing we forget. Once upon a time, senators were elected by the state legislatures. Yeah.
You know, another thing for the season that we're in that's so interesting is how many conventions were here in Baltimore.
Oh, yeah.
And including two in 1860 because the parties were splitting up so much that the Democrats first met in Charleston. And then there was a Southern walkout, and then they tried again here in Baltimore where they did nominate Stephen Douglas. Mm-hmm. But then there was another splinter group, which was called the Old Gentleman's Party because it was kind of the establishment, as we would call it today, that met here in Baltimore. It was all the time. And that allowed the women of Washington to go to conventions because it was right here. And one of the women who was very active politically was another Marylander, Anna Carroll, who wrote propaganda for the Union and is given a lot of the credit from keeping Maryland from seceding.
And she was a Carroll.
She was a Carroll.
Going back to the Carroll that signed the Declaration.
Yes, but she was an anti-Catholic Carroll.
the other side of the family.
She was a know-nothing.
Ah. I found it interesting that women of Washington would go to the Senate or the House and actually sit in the gallery and
all
listen and then talk about it later or write letters about it.
All the time. They were very political. But that goes back to the beginning.
But they couldn't vote.
I know. And it didn't mean that they couldn't have influence, though. They had a lot of influence. Hmm. And again, that does go back to the beginning. As soon as there was a Congress, women started showing up at it. And then when the government, the term of art, was removed to Washington, and they built the Capitol. That was the only place to go.
Right.
And so not only did people go there for congressional sessions, but they had church services there. Everything was there. It was, you know, it was a town with nothing in it.
I was interested in one more thing. What you learned about Washington, the swamp, the town, as it was still developing into the nation's capital. It seemed to have a sort of inferiority complex.
But that was another thing that the war did. And one of my inspirations for this was my own upbringing in Washington after World War II. And I saw how the city, the physical manifestation of the city's growth as a result of the wars, the two world wars. Because when I was a little kid, on the Mall, the National Mall, were these ugly, horrible, temporary buildings, they were called. They were essentially Quonset huts that had gone up to house the new agencies that had been created to carry out the missions of the wars. And then the new programs that got established during the wars. In the Civil War, it was things like the Homestead Act and the land-grant colleges and all of that. And so I was curious to see if Washington had taken a bigger role in the country after the Civil War the way it did in the 20th century. And the answer was absolutely yes. It was by the end of the war firmly established as a capital city in capital letters. Importantly, it was no longer these United States, but this United States.
In all of your research for this, was there any whisper of there someday being a woman in the White House, a president?
No, but there certainly was, you know, by the time of this book, which starts in 1848, which is when Seneca Falls happened, there was certainly a lot of discussion of voting.
Well, Cokie, thank you very much.
Oh, what a treat to be with you.
Yeah, thank you. Cokie Roberts' latest book is Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. It is published by HarperCollins. Speaking of books, it's time for a word from our sponsor.
Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy presents Howell S. Baum, author of Brown in Baltimore, which examines the desegregation of the Baltimore school system. Thursday, April 28th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Today's second book review from Paula Gallagher is a book about books, a collection of essays by famous and fairly famous people, Tommy Hilfiger, Al Roker, Margaret Atwood, Carl Hyacin, Laura Lippman, about the books that changed their lives.
Ask anyone the question, what is your favorite book, and you have the beginning of an interesting conversation. But twist that question just a bit, and you get a glimpse into that person's psyche. Editor Beth Ann Patrick does just that in the essay collection, The Books That Changed My Life, reflections by 100 authors, actors, musicians, and other remarkable people. From the poignant to the profound, these 2 to 3 page contemplations are fascinating, and just reading them makes you feel an immediate connection to that person. Singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash, daughter of Johnny, names Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder as her life-changing book. Ma and Pa Ingalls demonstrated the day-to-day routines of a loving, dependable family, making Little House a comfortable reprieve for the modern-day Cash, raised in a spotlight of fame, instability, and chaos. R.L. Stine, known for the popular Goosebumps series of scary novels for kids, reminds us that the original Pinocchio by Carlo Collodi was the stuff of childhood nightmares and not the charming Disneyfied version that implored us to give a little whistle. Many of the other essayists also chose a book from their childhood, including such classics as Grimm's Fairy Tales, Margaret Atwood, The Little Prince, Jacob Hemphill, and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Vu Tran. Others name coming-of-age adult classics they read as teens, from Gone with the Wind, Jodi Picoult, to The Bell Jar, Meg Wolitzer. Science fiction writer John Scalzi was a precocious reader who discovered The People's Almanac when he was just 6. The book ignited his love for trivia and curating facts of all kinds, whether or not he understood them. Washington Post Book World editor Ron Charles' choice, Straight Man by Richard Russo, was a literal life changer. Then a prep school English teacher, Charles picked up the novel from a table of newly published fiction at a local bookstore and decided to write a review, his first ever. He submitted it to the Christian Science Monitor, with more critiques to follow. He ultimately gave up teaching to become their full-time reviewer before moving on to the Washington Post. Charles says that newspaper readers, quote, overwhelmingly prefer to read positive reviews. They want to know which books they should read instead of books they should not read because they're not going to read most books anyhow. Consider this an overwhelmingly positive review of The Books That Changed My Life. For Roughly Speaking, I'm Paula Gallagher.
Paula Gallagher is a Baltimore County librarian who recommends books for Roughly Speaking listeners. A note, on Thursday evening, that's this Thursday, April 28th, I will be at the Owings Mills branch of the Baltimore County Public Library to lead a conversation with Angela Flournoy, the young author of a critically praised novel called The Turner House. That book was a National Book Awards finalist in fiction last year, The Turner House. More information about that conversation with Angela Flournoy can be found at bcpl.info. The event starts at 7 p.m. Today is April 26th, primary election day, and tomorrow, April 27th, marks 1 year since the funeral of Freddie Gray and the afternoon and evening of unrest in Baltimore. We wondered how the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture would be observing this anniversary. Charles Bethay is the museum's new chief curator. So tell me what went into the museum's thinking about the anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray and the uprising in Baltimore.
Well, one of the things that we wanted to do at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum was figure out a way that we could encapsulate everything about that ordeal. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to look at the entire situation and not just bits and pieces of the situation and try to approach this as a whole. So we created a theme for the entire year, calendar year of 2016, and considered it the year of the black man. What we're doing during this entire time period is looking at various exhibitions, programs, public programs, educational curriculum that's going to talk about African-American males, both past, present, and into the future, and look at the social, economical, political aspects of everything that deals with American and African-American males. There are a few exhibitions that are opening up. One has just recently opened up, entitled Be More Than the Story. This particular exhibition was a collaboration between the University of Maryland College to Park Design and graphic design students, and those of high school students right here in the city of Baltimore at Augusta Fells Institute for Visual Arts, and allow them to talk about what life was like for them leading up to the events that surround Freddie Gray's death, and the year following his death, including that of the uprising. Because the children, or at least these high school kids out in West Baltimore and other places, have been marginalized or ostracized in some capacity dealing with the uprising. So this gives them an opportunity, their voice, to say what they observe and how it is making them feel. You will be able to see things in this exhibition that will make you say, I didn't think about that. No paintings on the wall and so forth, but there are graphic elements that will make you think again about some of the statistics that are going on as far as police brutality in America, as well as here in the city of Baltimore, how students are reacting to the perceptions from the media, how they're perceived in the media and so forth. And you'll be able to get a better understanding and start to have some level of empathy with these particular people in these areas.
Another exhibition opening up Thursday, April 28th, Question Bridge Black Males. Now we get into your main theme of the year.
It's a nationally traveling exhibition. This is the first time it's coming to Maryland. And within the exhibition, the creators of it and the curators wanted to take African-American males of varying ages and allow them to ask questions of other African-American males in a very intimate, a very open, and a very loving manner, which covers a lot of things that, you know, we as men, not even just African-American men, but just men, have difficulties expressing to other men. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a black man in America? What does it mean when there are certain foods that if I eat, I'm automatically stereotyped? What does it mean when I say words that other people can't or should not say? What does it mean when people see me hanging around with other people who look just like me and I'm dressed in a certain way? These are the questions that people are asking amongst themselves intergenerationally, and they're getting some very interesting responses. So if you put that together in the context of what happened to a Freddie Gray and other African-American males around the country who've lost their lives due to some sort of violence or even police brutality for that matter, it puts things into a better perspective.
Interesting questions. Why am I a traitor for dating outside of my race? What's your greatest fear? So how is that presented, Charles?
Well, it's presented in a video format, and the overall format is about 3.5 hours long. Now, I had opportunity to see the exhibition in a few other venues. The creators did not believe people were going to sit and watch the entire thing. It was just enough to get in, see part of the conversation, be a part of the conversation, and move on. Well, this is a 3.5 hour presentation. And when a lot of the venues have realized the questions and the answers and the commentary is so engaging, people are actually sitting and watching it from beginning to end.
What do you think is the legacy of the death of Freddie Gray?
As a historian, I'm looking at what has transpired within the country over the last several years. And you have more and more news reports of African-American males dying at the hands of police or in police custody. This trend is not new. What has happened over the last few years with the advent of social media, people are learning about these atrocities a lot sooner. And therefore, we're taking an opportunity to shine a light on these things through the media and through other social platforms. So even though, unfortunately, these incidents have not stopped over a number of years, people are still becoming more aware towards them and starting to do more things to address them. It's no different than what folks are talking about with Black Lives Matter. I mean, that is the group that is, you know, bringing these things to bear at this point. But their message is not much different than what that message was in 1967 in Oakland, California, with the Black Panther Party's movement to also talk about police brutality. So history is repeating itself in some regard.
We have the videos now, the power of the cell phone camera.
We do.
To capture these images, that's undeniable what we're seeing. And I think a lot of white Americans now, their eyes are wide open to this issue. It's not just wishful thinking. I think it's been very powerful, it's had an effect on a lot of people. There are other folks who probably just resent the whole thing and take the side of the police no matter what. We've heard that too.
Right.
But I think there's a lot of other people who say, we've missed this. That complaint was there for a long time and we really didn't pay attention.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's the same thing when people talk about Black Lives Matter, and they say, well, you should talk about All Lives Matter. No one questions the fact that all lives matter, but the reality of it is there is a disparity when we're talking about African-American lives and the frequency as how they are lost in various situations.
Well, thank you very much, Charles. Look forward to seeing these exhibitions.
As you should. Good.
Charles Bethay is the chief curator of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture in Baltimore. More information about the exhibits he discussed at lewismuseum.org. That's our show for today. For producer Steve Early and my production assistant Holly Voetman, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening.
Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and, of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check it out at theivybookshop.com.